really is a pleasure to be here with you. It's been a long time since I've been able to meet with you all. Back when this group first got started and this group was meeting over in Upper Darby, we used to make it down most Sundays. And since that time, not so often. But it's just a real pleasure to be with you, see the nice meeting place that you have, and see the enthusiasm for this many people turning out on a Friday night. You nearly got the place full tonight. It's really encouraging. Our lesson, I hope, will be encouraging tonight. It's titled God Wins. And if you'll look at the... I walk up here with a songbook because I wanted to call attention to some of the language in it, and I don't know where it went. Can you get me that song we just sang? You'll see in the first stanza of that song, you'll see the idea of a fortress and a bulwark. What's that about? Well, that's talking about conflict, like a battle. As you come on down, you see our ancient foe mentioned in this song. And then you get to the second stanza, and you have this language, Lord Sabaoth. So that is a term that means Lord of Hosts. And usually that idea is Lord of Hosts in a great battle, the host on the Lord's side. And then you get to the end of that line, it says he must win the battle. I'm going to say a little bit tonight about the fact that we are in a battle. The whole world is in a battle. It's just that most of them don't know it. Jesus says in Matthew the 12th chapter, he that is not with me is against me. So everybody's on one side or the other. But most people never think about choosing a side, do they? They just end up on the wrong side. And the Lord wants everybody on his side. The fact is, in this battle, sometimes it looks like God's side is losing. And what I'm going to tell you tonight is, God wins. That's going to be the lesson. Now, your theme this weekend in this series is, you're calling these series Grow Conference. That's what we're calling these lessons. And we're going to talk a little bit about growing individually, growing collectively. When we talk about growing collectively, we're going to be talking about growing collectively in spiritual maturity as a congregation and growing numerically. And we're going to try to talk about some of all of that. I'll say more about that at the end of the lesson tonight. But let's jump into the lesson tonight. And I've got something I want to show you here. I want to show you a picture, a photograph from a little over a year ago, January of 2023. Photograph taken in the Mall of America in Bloomington, Minnesota. And this fella is there in the mall, and he's got his shirt on, and on the front it says, Jesus Saves. On the back it says, Jesus is the only way. And you may remember Jesus himself said, I'm going to have to drink water here. I don't know what it is, but got a... Is it the pollen? Yeah. Well, a little cloud of pollen must have just come by and I sucked it right in. If they could flavor it with a Philly cheesesteak flavor, then it... All right, so he's got this shirt on. He's got that coexist symbol on the back. Various symbols in that. You see that on bumper stickers on cars. Have you seen that? And it represents various religious ideas. You've got Islam. You've got Judaism. You've got Taoism. You've got a cross for Christianity and some other symbols there. And the idea, I guess, behind that symbol is they're all of equal value, which means none of them are of unique value. And nothing really matters. He's got that crossed out. And so he just says, Jesus, there's not a whole bunch of ways. Jesus is the only way. And he's walking through the mall with this shirt on his way to Macy's. And he is accosted by these security people. And there are three of them. The one in the foreground is the one who does most of the talking in the conversation that they had. Now I have to tell you, full disclosure, about a week before this, this fellow was apparently preaching on mall property. And I don't remember. I think maybe he was in the parking lot. I'm not sure. Apparently some people were perturbed by that. But on this particular occasion, all he is doing is walking through the mall on his way to Macy's, wearing a shirt that says, Jesus is the only way. Jesus said, saves. So these armed security guys come up. And one of them says to him, Jesus is associated with religion and is offending people. So just the way he said that, religion. That's a bad thing. And Jesus is associated with it. So that's a bad thing. People are offended. He went on. People have been offended. Like I said, all we are asking you, take your shirt off and you can go to Macy's, or you can leave. Now, I don't have his side of the conversation on screen for you here, but listening to the audio, he was very calm. He was not combative. He was not aggressive. He wasn't intending to take his shirt off, but he was very calm and respectful. Here's what the security people kept saying to him. Take your shirt off and you can go to Macy's and go do your shopping. Or you can leave the mall, okay? Those are your only two options right now. If you want to shop here, you need to take that shirt off. Again, sir, it is religious soliciting. There is no soliciting allowed on mall property, which is private property. Now, all right, private property. You know, this is not the point. This is a little beside the point, but we get into these discussions. This lesson tonight is not about free speech. This lesson is not about the fact that I have the right to speak freely wherever I want. But we do have this discussion, you know, in my house. If you come into my house and you're saying things that I don't want said in my house, I can ask you to leave, right? That's my private property. Public property, you're supposed to have, you know, freedom of speech. And then we have these properties that are not owned by the government, so in a sense they're private, but on the other hand, they invite the public. So we get into a whole discussion. That's not my concern tonight, is to how to solve where you can say what. What I'm more concerned about is to illustrate the fact that there is a spirit of opposition to the gospel in the world in which we live. He continues, you're walking, wearing that shirt in the whatever, and we've got guests, whatever, saying they've been offended by your shirt. Take the shirt off and you can go shopping. In the end, he did not have to take his shirt off. He was able to go on to Macy's. The following week, so this went viral, and it was in the news. And so the following week, here's what happened. These people showed up with shirts that either just say Jesus or Jesus saves or Jesus is the way. And I have to tell you, I was a little bit gratified by that. Maybe more than a little bit. I thought, yes, way to go. But the message tonight is not God's going to win and you're going to get to wear your jersey or your shirt that says Jesus saves in the mall. That is not the point. What I do want you to understand is there's an attitude that prevails in our society, in our culture, that's reflected in this incident. My guess is that some of the executives of the Mall of America would just assume this had never happened. They're not interested in being in the news for running people out for wearing some shirt or another shirt. My guess is that these security guys kind of took this on themselves. I'm going to tell you, I had a daughter. I don't think it was Amy. I think it was one of the next two. Yeah, I know it was either Holly or Amanda. I think it was Holly. Took her Bible to high school with her one time. And her friends were shocked. You're not allowed to do that, are you? I don't think you can have a Bible in school. Where's that coming from? Is there a law against having a Bible in school? No. But our culture has promoted such an attitude of opposition to religion and specifically to Christianity that people think that's true. And I suspect these security guys were freelancing a little bit, but they sincerely thought this should not be allowed. We can't allow people to come in here with a shirt that says Jesus saves. What that illustrates is a spirit of the age. Or if we go to, we'll go to Ephesians in a minute. All right, so what we're going to do tonight is we're going to talk about this culture of opposition to the gospel. And sometimes we see this opposition to the gospel and we get the idea that God's side is losing. We're losing ground. And what we're going to do is we're going to go through the book of Acts. And we're going to see opposition to the gospel in the book of Acts. And we're going to look at the motives behind it. And then we're going to go back through and we're going to see that in each of those instances, even though it looked like God was losing, God was winning. That's what we're going to try to do here. I think I missed a slide, but we'll go on. All right, so we're going to look at Acts chapter 4 and verse 1 here. In Acts chapter 3, Peter and John have gone into the temple, and they have healed a lame man so that he can now walk. And this gets a crowd, and you can understand that. So Peter starts preaching. And among other things, he talks about how his audience, the Jews in his audience, had killed the Prince of Life, but God raised him up. Talks about the resurrection. And he keeps on preaching, and you come to Acts chapter 4 in verse 1. As they were speaking to the people, the priests and the captain of the temple guard and the Sadducees came up to them. Now we need to understand who the Sadducees are. I think probably all of you understand that among Jewish society at that time, you had different sects within Judaism. You had, in the Bible, it talks about Pharisees, they were Jews, and Sadducees, they were Jews. But the Sadducees were famous for not believing in the resurrection. In Acts chapter 23 and verse 8, Luke tells us, Sadducees said there's no resurrection, no angel, no spirit. In other words, the Sadducees were kind of the modernists of their day. They were the people who didn't believe anything they couldn't see with their eyes. The irony is, they were in control of the upper echelons of the priesthood. These are the people that control the highest offices in Jewish religion, and they don't believe in angels or spirits or resurrection. Well, the problem was, of course, the Sadducees are greatly disturbed because they, Peter and John, were teaching the people and proclaiming in Jesus the resurrection from the dead. Notice it doesn't say they were proclaiming that Jesus was raised from the dead. They were proclaiming in Jesus the resurrection from the dead. What's the difference? When they're proclaiming in Jesus the resurrection from the dead, they're not just saying Jesus was raised. They're saying because Jesus was raised, he has power over death and he can raise you. You can be raised from the dead. All right? Well, go on in the text and it says, many of those who heard the message believed. And the number of men came to be about 5,000. Thousands of Jews are believing this message of resurrection, that they have a hope of resurrection. And their religious leaders, their authorities, the highest authorities in Judaism, do not believe in resurrection. Those people, the Sadducees, they have power over their constituency, but if their constituency starts to believe that the Sadducees are wrong about the resurrection, that's going to undermine the credibility and the authority of these Sadducees, these religious leaders here. And so that's a problem. In Acts chapter 5, there is another occasion when the Sadducees arrest the apostles, and this time it's not just Peter and John. It's often thought that all the apostles are arrested here, maybe, I'm not sure, but certainly more than just Peter and John are arrested. And they're called, the apostles are called before the council, and the Sadducees are part of that council. The high priest stood up along with his associates, that is the sect of the Sadducees, it tells us that again, and they were filled with jealousy. Do you get why the jealousy? So we often use the word jealousy in where we mean envious. I'm jealous that you have some nice shoes there. And so that's really envious. Jealousy is more when I'm protective of what I have. A jealous husband. A jealous husband doesn't want, it's his wife. He does not want his wife's attentions going to anyone else. An overly jealous husband can be a problem. God is a jealous God. In Exodus, the 20th chapter, make no graven images. And he says, have no other gods before me. Do not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. What's he mean by that? You are my people. I don't want your attentions going to any other supposed God. You worship me. You're my people. That's the way the Sadducees thought of the Jewish people, their constituency. You're my people. You're our people. And if you start believing in somebody who says there's a resurrection and you go start following them, we're going to lose our constituency. And if we lose our constituency, we lose our power.
So they were opposing the gospel because their power was threatened. That's one. We got a lot of other occasions in the book of Acts where the gospel is opposed. We'll look at several motives. The next one's going to be in Acts the 13th chapter. In verse 42, Paul and Barnabas have come into what would be modern-day Turkey, in Galatia, specifically in the city of Antioch. And they go into the synagogue, and they're preaching in the synagogue, synagogue of the Jews. And it says, as Paul and Barnabas were going out, the people repeatedly begged to have these things spoken to them the next Sabbath. I think that would be so encouraging. Go into a place where you've got a bunch of people who are not believers in Jesus, and they just say, please come back to us and talk to us more about this next week. And the text goes on, it says, now when the meeting of the synagogue had broken up, many of the Jews and the God-fearing proselytes followed Paul and Barnabas, God-fearing proselytes. So there's some discussion, some controversy about exactly what that means, but what this much is clear, these would have been Gentiles who to one degree or another had embraced the idea of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And they, to some degree, worshipped. They may have attended in the synagogue with the Jews. And so it says, many of the Jews and the God-fearing proselytes followed Paul and Barnabas, who were speaking to them and urging them to continue in the grace of God. So what happens the next Sabbath? The next Sabbath, nearly all the city assembled to hear the word of the Lord. Well, that's great! But wait a minute, if it's all the city, it's not just Jews, and it's not just Gentiles who kind of worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's all the city, all the Gentiles. And so what happens? It says, when the Jews saw the crowds, they were filled with jealousy. Here's that idea of jealousy again. But it's a little different this time. Before it was the Sadducees saying, these are our people. We don't want them going off and following these apostles teaching this resurrection thing. Now, it's Jews whose attitude is, this is our kingdom. This is a Jewish thing. This is a Jewish kingdom. And we don't want these Gentiles to come in and take it over. And so it's a kind of a selfish, us-only mentality that motivates them to oppose the preaching of gospel. We see this again in Acts the 17th chapter. Now Paul is traveling with Silas, and he comes to Thessalonica. And he goes into the synagogue there. And if I remember right, it says he reasoned three Sabbath days, three different Sabbath days. He's teaching from the Old Testament scriptures about the Christ, the Messiah. And verse 4 says, some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, along with a great multitude of the God-fearing Greeks, and not a few of the leading women. But the Jews, becoming jealous, taking along some wicked men from the marketplace and forming a mob, set the city in an uproar. Again, you have this selfish us-only thing. We don't want this message going out to all the Gentiles and them getting in on this. This is our kingdom. This is a Jewish kind of a kingdom. In Acts the 16th chapter, we have another motive. So in Acts the 16th chapter, Paul and Silas have come to Philippi. And Philippi is in Europe. And so this is the first time Paul is going to preach the gospel in Europe. He comes to Neapolis, but he apparently doesn't spend any time there. He just goes right on up the road to Philippi. And he's preaching the gospel, and it happened that as we were going to the place of prayer, a slave woman who had a spirit of divination met us, who was bringing great profit to her master. You can always already see where this is going, what the motive for opposition is going to be here, can't you? So it says that she had a spirit of divination. I'm going to take a minute to tell you a little bit about this spirit of divination. The original language, it says she had a spirit of a python. A python. A snake. She had a spirit of a snake. Did you know that? So there was this Greek myth, the Greek gods. And the myth was that one of their deities, Apollo, had killed this python, this snake. And there was a temple built in honor of Apollo in Delphi, which is about 50 miles north of Corinth. And the spirit of that python was supposed to live on in that place. And there was a priestess in that place. And she would prophesy. Now, there's not a lot of real clear information, but the information we have seems to indicate that what she would do is She just gibberish. And some people think it was affected by the vapors coming up out of the chasm. And so she would do this. And then there were other priests around her that would take her gibberish and interpret it for the people. And it was supposed to be telling the future, fortune telling. And this whole idea then spread throughout that part of the world. And there were various people around that part of the world who would be dialed into this Python myth. And so you're familiar with, so this young woman here, who this slave girl in Philippi, says she has a spear of the Python, and her masters, her handlers, are making money off of her by her fortune telling. Well, all right. It says she has a spirit, an unclean spirit, demon, something like that. Are you familiar with the fact that sometimes people possessed with unclean spirits were blind as a result? Or dumb, couldn't speak, that the spirits affected people that way? Could you imagine that an unclean spirit could affect this young woman in such a way that she just sounded strange, made weird sounds? There are a couple of terms that are used for this ancient practice of making weird sounds that got interpreted as fortune telling. One is gastromancy. Gastro, stomach. Mancy, prophecy. Stomach prophesying. In other words, your stomach, and somebody goes, oh, he just said, and then. And there's another term called, look at your face. The other term is ventriloquism, but not ventriloquism where you have a dummy here and you make everybody think the dummy's talking. But ventriloquism, again, in the sense that there's weird sounds coming out of your body. These are the terms that are used. And it was a thing. They thought, you know, when somebody was doing that, they were prophesying. I could envision, I don't know this exactly what was happening, but I could envision this young woman is possessed by an unclean spirit, a demon. And the result is she makes weird sounds, whether they're coming from or whether they're coming or what, but she makes weird sounds. And so her owners, her handlers, we can make money off of this. And so they take her out, somebody pays the money, and she, and then they say, well, she just said, and they tell them what prophecy, and people pay the money. I'm going to come back to her in a minute, tell you what she was saying that was intelligible. But Paul cast that unclean spirit out of her, which means there's no more weird sounds coming out of her. And what's the result of that? These guys aren't going to make any more money. When her masters saw that their hope of profit was suddenly gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace before the authorities, and they're thrown in jail. So here the gospel was just about to make progress in Europe, and it gets shut down. And it looks like, everything's going wrong. We're losing. We'll come back to that. But the motive here was financial loss. And we see that motive again in Acts the 19th chapter. In Acts the 19th chapter, we have Paul coming to Ephesus. Ephesus was the home of the Temple of Artemis, which was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. How many of you have heard of the seven wonders of the ancient world? All right. One of those was this great big temple of Artemis, and it was famous, and people from all over would come to see that. When they came, they would buy little knickknacks, little miniatures. They might be miniatures of the temple or miniatures of Artemis herself. And there were craftsmen in Ephesus, silversmiths, who would make those things, and they're making a living selling those things to all these tourists who come into town to see this temple. And here comes Paul into Ephesus, and he's preaching that gods that are made with hands are not gods. And so, about that time, a major disturbance occurred in regard to the way of Jesus. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. For a man named Demetrius, a silversmith who made silver shrines of Artemis, was bringing considerable business to the craftsmen. And he gathered these men together with the workmen of similar trades and said, men, you know that our prosperity depends upon this business. You see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul is persuaded and turned away a considerable number of people saying that gods made by hands are not gods at all. And so they start a riot, and you may be familiar with the story. They're opposing the preaching of Paul. And why is that? Well, it's financial loss is the motive. There's danger that this trade of ours will fall into disrepute. And so we'll put that up there. And then there is another motive that we want to see. Paul himself. Do you remember, of course, that Paul himself had opposed the gospel? Paul himself, before he was a believer, before he was a Christian, he was persecuting Christians. In fact, he was present for the stoning of Stephen. In fact, he was the one that instigated the persecution that caused the church to be scattered from Jerusalem. He was the one going into people's houses and trying to find any Jews who believed that Jesus was the Christ, and he'd arrest them if he found them. That's what Paul was doing. Paul, later on, after, of course, he is a believer and he is an apostle, he says in Acts 26, verse 9, "So I thought to myself that I had to act in strong opposition to the name of Jesus of Nazareth." Paul opposed the gospel of Jesus Christ. What was his motive? I think we can reason by considering what caused him to change his mind. And what caused him to change his mind was when he saw Jesus alive. Some people miss the fact that he actually saw Jesus, but he says he saw Jesus repeatedly. Barnabas says he saw Jesus. He saw Jesus alive. And when he saw Jesus, he knew, oh, he has been raised from the dead. He is the Christ. I've been wrong. So before that, the reason he was opposed to the gospel must have been because he did not believe that Jesus had been raised from the dead. And he therefore did not believe that Jesus was the Christ. And so it's just plain old unbelief was his motive for opposing the gospel. All right, so those are some of the things that we see in the book of Acts, reasons for opposition to the gospel. And in all of these things, what I want you to understand is the devil is at work. In Ephesians, the second chapter, this is a slide I thought I had missed earlier, but here it is. In Ephesians, the second chapter, in verse 1, Paul says, "And you were dead in your offenses," or your trespasses and sins, "in which you previously walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience." I want you to think about that expression, the prince of the power of the air. Of the air. Why does he call it the prince of the power of the air? Air is everywhere. Air just surrounds us. And what he is saying is the devil's influence is just everywhere. And you know, we look at the world we live in, and can you not say, yes, that's true. Everywhere. I don't care whether it's attitudes about sexual immorality or honesty or irreverence or whatever it is, in our entertainment, on the sidewalk as you're walking up and down the street, in our schools, just everywhere, like it's just saturating the air. The devil is at work. His influence is there. That was the way it was then. That's the way it is now. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 18, Paul writes to this new church at Thessalonica. He'd gone to Thessalonica, and there the Jews had stirred up trouble for him. We saw this a moment ago. And as a result, he went to Berea. He left Thessalonica. And the Jews from Thessalonica came and stirred up trouble in Berea. So he left Berea, and he went down to Athens. And he went from Athens to Corinth. And then he wrote a letter back to the brethren in Thessalonica. And when he did, he said, "For we wanted to come to you." I was wanting to come back and see you. "I, Paul," more than once, "and Satan hindered us." Who hindered it? Well, the Jews who were opposing the gospel. But what Paul says it was Satan did it. And we need to learn to think that way. We need to recognize that it is Satan that is at work when the gospel is being opposed. I don't want the takeaway to be tonight that, okay, these people are our enemies. The Jews through whom Satan worked, Paul was trying to convert them. But Satan is at work in all of this. So we need to recognize that Satan is at work. We ought to not just say, well, you know, we have different viewpoints. I like that coexist symbol. Well, I have this faith, and you have that, and that's all. And that's all okay. We need to recognize Satan is behind all of that. It's opposition to the gospel. It's his influence in this world. And it doesn't come like that. You know, Satan does not influence the world by saying, "Hey, I'm a really bad guy, and I got some really awful ideas, and you'll be condemned eternally if you follow them here." That's not the way it works, is it? 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 13. Paul says, for such men are false apostles, deceitful workers, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. No wonder, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. Therefore, it's not surprising if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness, whose end will be according to their deeds. Think about the world we live in. When people promote sexual immorality, homosexuality, transgenderism, whatever you want to think about, how do they sell their ideas? Love, tolerance. That's always, they end up in some contradictions, you know, because they'll be tolerant of everybody except those who don't agree with them. But the fact is, they paint the picture of themselves and their views as good and righteous and loving and tolerant. Like, well, you know, that's how Satan works. And it just pervades this world. And sometimes we look around at what's going on in this world and we think he's winning. And it gets discouraging. And we wonder, what's wrong? But God is also at work. Not talking about God giving us the right to wear the Jesus Saves shirt to the mall. If you want to wear a Jesus Saves shirt to the mall, go ahead. But that's not what I'm talking about. Let's go back through these oppositions to the gospel in the book of Acts and the motivations behind them. And let's see what God was doing. In Acts chapter 1, when Saul was approving putting Stephen to death, and then that instigates a great persecution against the church in Jerusalem. They're all scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria except for the apostles. Best I can tell, best I understand, up until this point, the entire church of Jesus Christ was in Jerusalem. And they were growing, and they were thriving. And now, what happens? Persecution, they just scattered to the wind. And I can imagine Satan looking at this situation and saying, oh, this was growing. I had to do something. Persecution. Now, they're scattered, like throwing a grenade in a china shop or something, just blowing everything to smithereens. And Satan wins. What happened? Well, those who had been scattered went through places preaching the word. These people were people from all different countries. They were Jews, but they were Jews who had come to Jerusalem from many different countries, all around North Africa and the Middle East and Europe, parts of Europe. And now they go back there and they take the gospel with them. And the gospel spreads and God wins. How about financial loss? That occasion when Paul and Silas cast that demon or that unclean spirit, the spirit of the python out of the so-called python, out of the girl in Philippi. So here's this opportunity for Paul to start preaching in Europe, and instead, Paul and Silas gets thrown in jail. And again, you can imagine the devil. Snuff that one out. Put a stop to that. What comes of it? The jailer asked for light. So what happened? Paul and Silas were in jail and an earthquake comes. They've been singing and praying to God. An earthquake comes and their restraints are broken. And the jailer thinks they've all escaped. And Paul says, do yourself no harm. We're all here. And he bursts in and calls for lights. And then the jailer says, what must I do to be saved? And the result is this jailer and his household become part of the beginning of the church in Philippi. Has it ever occurred to you that it seems a little, if you were a jailer and you've got some prisoners and you don't know anything about Jesus, and there's an earthquake and you're praying that Jesus, prisoners have escaped, and you run in there and they're still sitting there, first words out of your mouth, what must I do to be saved? Does that ever cross your mind that just seems, where did that come from? And a lot of people think that that's just all it was, and maybe it was. But I kind of wonder if there wasn't something else going on here. Let me show you something. This is an aerial view of Philippi. This is the city where this girl with the spirit of the python, where Paul and Silas ended up in jail. And you go from the northeast to the southwest there, and you go from one side of the city to the other, and that's just about 600 meters, about an 8-minute walk. That was not a big geographic footprint. That's all it was. You recognize that? Anybody recognize that? I think that's just about two blocks down there.
The Wharton School.
Yeah.
The School of Business.
Okay, and about two blocks down there.
Yeah, right.
And that's just a little over 600 meters. And in fact, Google Maps, I think, says it's a 9-minute walk. So from here to there is the distance we're talking about. That South University, at the intersection of South University and Walnut, or whatever this is. From here to there, you can walk across Philippi from here to there. Don't you imagine? Let me show you this. Paul is preaching. Where are you preaching? Well, this is the forum. This is the agora, the marketplace. Those would be typical places Paul might be preaching. Given the general size of that, Paul was many days in Philippi. It says this woman with the spirit of the python was following him for many days. There's a guy these two blocks for many days preaching Jesus. Would it be odd to think that people would have heard him? Maybe the jailer would have heard him? But the jailer had not become a believer. He had not become a Christian. Now, if you go to Philippi, they will tell you that the jail is right there, just across the street, well, catty corner across the street from the forum. There's a lot of questions about whether that's actually the jail or not. There's not a whole lot of evidence to support it, to my knowledge. But wherever the jail was in that city, it's not that big a city. So what do you have here? If what I'm thinking is what happened, you've got this jailer, and he's maybe heard some of the preaching of Paul and Silas over the many days that they've been preaching. But he has not become a Christian. And Satan wants to snuff this out, put a stop to the spread of the gospel here in this first European city. Has them arrested, and they're in jail. And the result is, this jailer, who had not yet made the commitment, what must I do to be saved? And he is baptized the same hour of the night, he and his household, and God wins. How about that selfish, us-only attitude on the part of the Jews at Antioch? When the Jews saw the crowds, they were filled with jealousy and began contradicting the things spoken by Paul and were blaspheming. What came of that? Paul and Barnabas spoke out boldly and said, "It was necessary the word of God be spoken to you first. Since you repudiate it and consider yourselves unworthy of eternal life, behold, we're turned into the Gentiles." And so now, the gospel is, the door is open. They just go preaching to Gentiles, and a whole new part of the world is embracing the gospel. God wins. How about the power-threatened motive when the Sadducees felt their power was threatened? So they arrested Peter and John, and then they arrested the apostles. When they arrested Peter and John, then they had to release them. Had to release them because the guy that Peter and John healed, the lame man, he's standing right there. They really could not. I mean, what are they going to say? These guys didn't do any miracle. Guy's standing right there. So they had to release Peter and John. And when they do, Peter and John come back to the disciples, and the disciples are rejoicing. And they quote this passage from Psalm 2. They quote this passage, "The kings of the earth took their stand, and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against his Christ," his anointed one, his Messiah. So in the psalm, it describes this idea of rulers, political rulers, kings, who are going to throw off God's restraints. They're going to do whatever they want. They're not going to be subject to God. And God laughs at them. And then his anger comes out, and he says, "I have installed my Christ. I have chosen who is going to be my Christ. And I have established my kingdom." And that's what's going to happen. And so these people, in Acts chapter 4, these disciples, they have seen Jesus be crucified after he was tried by Pilate, sent by Pilate to Herod, sent back from Herod to Pilate, these rulers, and Jesus has been put to death. And now they've seen the apostles, Peter and John, be arrested. And they think of that psalm, Psalm 2, and they think, you know what? God's told us this is the way it is. These political leaders, these rulers, they're going to oppose us. But God's already told us that. And he's already told us he's established his kingdom, his Christ. This is happening just like God said it would. God's got this. For truly in this city, then go ahead and explain. In this city, there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod, Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel, to do whatever your hand and purpose predestined to occur. Now, Lord, look at their threats and grant it to your bondservants to speak the word with all confidence. God wins. Yeah, Peter and John got arrested, but these people just saw that as evidence that, and then they released, these people just saw that as, God's already said, this is what's going to happen. God's got this. And they become all the more confident. In Acts chapter 5, after more of the apostles arrested, and then they're released, they went on their way from the presence of the council, rejoicing that they had been considered worthy to suffer shame for his name. God wins. We look at the book of Acts, and as you go through it, it's really amazing how the gospel spreads. How many were baptized on the day of Pentecost? 3,000. You get to Acts chapter 4, how many believers are there? Just counting the men, there are 5,000. You go on through the book of Acts, and the kingdom spreads. The disciples, because of the persecution, scattered throughout the world. You get to Acts chapter 10, Cornelius, Gentiles start hearing the gospel. By the time you get to the end of the book of Acts, you're at the time where Paul can say in Colossians chapter 2, the gospel has been preached in all creation under heaven. Within 30 years of the time that Jesus was crucified. That's how the gospel spread as it was being opposed for all these different motives that we've talked about. God was winning. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we had 3,000 people baptized tonight? We sometimes look at that and we say, why isn't that happening today? And we get discouraged. And sometimes we'll see news stories and they'll tell us that Christianity is shrinking. We say, well, in the Bible it was growing. And today, Christianity is shrinking. Is it? This is a graph from a Pew Research poll done, I think it was done early last year, if I'm thinking right. Could have been the previous year, but I think it was early last year. And they say that in 1972, 90% of Americans were Christians. And then they say in 2020, 64% of Americans were Christians. Well, that sounds like God's losing. That sounds like a decline, doesn't it? And then they project forward 2070, they say the people who say they're Christians in the United States of America will be a minority. And sometimes people look at that and they get discouraged and they say, things are going the wrong way. I have two things I want to tell you about that. First of all, Christianity, true Christianity, will always be a minority. Jesus said in Matthew, the 7th chapter, verse 13, enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide, and the way is broad, that leads to destruction, and there are many who enter through it. For the gate is narrow, and the way is constricted, that leads to life, and there are few who find it. But the other thing that I want to say to you is, what we're seeing here is not Christianity shrinking, not true Christianity. What we're seeing is the demise of superficial Christianity, nominal Christianity. In 1972, were 90% of Americans Christians? I started high school in 1972. I'm going to tell you, 90% of Americans were not Christians. It might be if you took a poll, there'd be 90% of people say, yeah, I'm a Christian. 90% of the people were not Christians. In 2020, now a lot of you do not remember 1972. How many of you remember 1972? One, two, three, four, five of us. We're a shrinking number.
Actually, people who say they remember it weren't really there.
Okay. You did live through it. But nonetheless, we do remember 2020. That's just 4 years ago. 4 years ago, were 64% of Americans Christians? I guess if somebody took a poll, 64% of people said, yeah, I'm a Christian. But were 64% of people true Christians? So what's happening? What you're seeing is the demise of superficial, nominal Christianity. People say, yeah, I'm a Christian, when they're not really. And I tell you, that's a good thing. as you look at what is said to be Christianity, there's a lot of, well, there are going to be some who oppose Christianity for political power, but I'm going to tell you, there are also some who are going to endorse Christianity, who are going to say they are Christians for political power. Don't believe that every politician who says God bless America is on God's side. I want to say a word about this. Do you remember that girl, the spear of the python, in Philippi? I told you I'd come back to this and tell you what she was saying that you could understand. Do you remember what she was saying that you could understand? She was following Paul for many days. You remember what she was saying? She was saying, these men are servants of the Most High God and proclaim unto you the way of salvation. That sounds good. Paul was troubled by that. And he cast the spirit out of her and put a stop to that. Paul did not want to be associated with her ilk. Paul did not want to be associated with that. I think sometimes we get suckered into the idea. Some politician comes along and says, God bless America. And he's one of us. He's a Christian. Don't fall for that. There are politicians who are going to use that to get into office, just as there are other ones who are going to oppose Christianity to get into office. It kind of depends on their constituency, who's ever in their district. I don't want to be attached to that, just like Paul didn't want to be attached to that girl. Some oppose Christianity for money, but some will endorse Christianity for money. Paul says in 1 Timothy 6 chapter, I believe it's verse 5, he says, there are some who see godliness as a way of gain. That's not true Christianity. And then there are going to be some who oppose the gospel due to unbelief, but I'm going to tell you there are some who endorse the gospel though in unbelief. I think most people would be astonished if they understood how many pastors, how many clergymen in the various denominations there are who do not believe that Jesus was literally born of a virgin, who do not believe Jesus took 5 literal loaves and 2 fish and fed 5,000 people, who do not believe Jesus walked on the water, who do not believe that Jesus was literally raised from the dead, and yet they're religious leaders. Well, we saw that in the book of Acts, the Sadducees. They were religious leaders. They didn't believe in the resurrection, or angels, or spirits. There's a lot of unbelievers in so-called Christianity. And so when we start seeing these polls that say, Christianity's getting fewer and fewer, what you're seeing is a purging effect, a pruning effect. And that's a good thing. And as it happens, what we need to be is we need to be the true people of God who are truly lights in this world, the people who look around, instead of being turned off by shallow, superficial, hypocritical Christianity, they can see in us something real, and God wins. I want to call your attention to a couple of passages in 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 12. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing. Another translation says you're proving, as though something strange were happening to you. For fiery ordeal, hardships, trials, persecution, it comes upon you and it tests you, it proves you. His allusion here is to the process of refining metals, refining gold. In fact, he talks about refining gold. We'll come to this passage in just a minute. You all used to have, years ago when this congregation first got started meeting over in Upper Darby, there was a fellow in this congregation who would take in gold that people would bring in. He'd melt it down, and I don't know what he did with it, but I don't think he kept it. But anyway, but you're familiar. You get gold ore, and there's other stuff in there that's not gold. And you just want the gold. And so you heat it up really hot, melt it into a liquid, and it separates out. You can pull off all the stuff that's not gold, and you're left with just the pure gold. But what is it that does that? Hot, hot, hot. A lot of heat, enough to melt metal. And that's what Peter's talking about here. And that's what we're seeing going on in the world around us right now. So Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 6, "In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials, so that the proof of your faith, the testing of it, the purifying of it, the refining of it, being more precious than gold, which perishes, though tested by fire." Interestingly, he alludes to the fact that ultimately even gold itself is going to be destroyed by fire in the end. And he says, "perishes, though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise, glory, and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ." God is winning. Sometimes we may look around us and we may feel like things are going bad. But even as it seems that way, there's a purifying, refining process going on. And I'll tell you, when there's less superficial Christianity, those who are true Christianity, who are true Christians, are going to be more visible, more recognizable, more stand out, more identifiable, and so somebody who's looking for the truth can spot it. So we need to be there to be that. All right, I said I would come back to this idea that is kind of the theme, and that is Grow Conference. Growing individually, growing collectively. If you set out to accomplish something, if you want to work to make progress, grow, whatever it is the endeavor is, it's hard to do when you feel like there's no hope, when you feel like it's futile, it's fruitless. I hope what we've done tonight is to say, we know how this comes out. God wins. I want to call your attention to Matthew chapter 12, and this is the passage with which we're going to close. This is the passage where Jesus cast out a demon, and they said, well, he did it by the spirit of Beelzebub. In other words, they just dismissed his miracle, and they said, well, he just did it by Satan's power. And Jesus says, no, that doesn't make any sense. And then he says in verse 28, if I by the spirit of God cast out demons, then is the kingdom of God come upon you. And then he says, how can one enter the house of the strong man and spoil his goods, except you first bind the strong man, and then he'll spoil his house. What he's talking about here, Jesus casting out demons was a precursor to his casting down Satan himself and defeating Satan in the resurrection. What he's going to do is, he is going to enter into Satan's house and take Satan's goods. You know what Satan's goods are? All of us who are lost in sin, and everybody who's still in sin. And Jesus is going to win those. That's why I said earlier, when we start talking about there being a war, our enemy, our opponents, are not those people who have been deceived by Satan's ways. But Satan is working through them. And Satan wants them, but Jesus wants them. And so he's going to enter in and he's going to take from Satan these people. But first he's going to bind Satan. And that's anticipated as he cast out those who are Satan's, the demons, the unclean spirits, and then ultimately he's going to defeat Satan when he is raised from the dead, and he's going to spoil his house. And then he says, he that is not with me is against me. He that is not with me is against me. That's why I said, I think I said at the very beginning, there's a war, and it's not just a war between Ukraine and Russia, and it's not just between Hamas and Israel. There's a war, and everybody's in it. But what we are the goods. And God is wanting to win as many of us as he can. And he's going to win the war. And those who don't choose to be on God's side, the victorious side, are going to end up with Satan. And they're going to be defeated and eternally condemned. We know how it's going to come out. God wins. So let's be on God's side. Thank you for your attention tonight. That's our study tonight. I look forward to talking with you tomorrow.